From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today on Intersection, we continue our conversation about diversity and inclusivity at the University of Missouri. Last week, we spoke with UM System Interim President Mike Middleton and with Angela Speck, Professor and Chair of the Faculty Council Diversity Enhancement Committee at MU. This week, we're talking with students at Mizzou about what diversity and inclusivity mean to them. This is the second in a two-part show, and you can listen to both our shows at kbia.org. Over the past few months, race and racism have been at the center of conversations about this university and many others. Protests that included demands for direct address of racism on campus, increased hiring of faculty of color, and removal of MU System President Tim Wolfe led to Wolfe's resignation. Now the university is looking for a way forward. In conversations about that way forward, you often hear several words used, including the words diversity and inclusivity. But those words can mean different things to different people. So today, we're talking with several students at MU about what those words mean to them. Rivu Desgupta is the student coordinator for diversity peer educators at Mizzou. It takes quite a bit of training to become a diversity peer educator, and students then go on to facilitate conversations with groups around campus.
As a peer, my job is to go to faculties, offices, staff, student organizations, Greek houses, and just have conversations about inclusivity and diversity. I think it's important to note that we don't ever go in with an agenda or with this idea that we're going to change people's minds or things like that. We go in with the idea that we want people to talk about themselves, the experiences they're having, and we strongly believe that with that, everyone's going to end up at a better place after that conversation in terms of inclusivity. Just hearing your peer stories and things like that, that's going to progress a lot more than us coming in and saying, here's what you all need to think.
And when we're talking about diversity and inclusivity, what are we talking about? I think some people may think those sort of sound like the same things.
Yeah, so diversity and inclusivity, I prefer the term inclusivity because diversity's been kind of thrown around so often that it's lost meaning. Inclusivity is an attitude expressed by a person, group, or a space where certain identities, all identities really, can feel comfortable and not threatened in that space. So inclusivity kind of abandons this notion that diversity is a numbers game. For example, a diversity as a numbers game approach might be this many people in like this group. And now, that's not to say that it doesn't have a place in certain spaces. For example, I know Concerned Student 1950, one of their demands was having a 10% increase or 10% base level for faculty and staff. So diversity has its place in certain respects. However, inclusivity differs in that it's not necessarily about that 10%. It's about, okay, if there was this one person of this one identity, would they feel comfortable here? The reason inclusivity is preferred is because you can't have quotas with all identities. For example, trans identities. It's completely unrealistic when you don't have 10% of the student body as openly trans because it's just not safe to ask that the faculty be 10% trans. And so when looking at issues of identity and isolation, diversity becomes a useful topic, but when looking, or useful word rather, but when looking at just the broad spectrum of all possible identities, inclusivity is what we would like to prefer because we want that one person who identifies as a trans woman of color to feel safe in a certain space. If that person feels safe in the space, then the space is inclusive.
And when we're talking about people sharing their stories, I understand what you're saying because it seems like it would be impossible to go and tell a group of people, you should behave this way, because I'm not sure that that's how people learn behaviors.
Yeah.
When people are sharing their stories, how do you sort of facilitate that? And have you seen any moments of real sort of understanding blossom between people?
Actually, one of the coolest things about doing facilitations is the fact that you do them for organizations where people know each other really well. So, for example, some of my favorite examples are facilitations for Greek chapters because these are people who call each other brother and sister. And afterwards, I've had people come up to me and say things like, I had no idea my sister went through that, my brother went through that. that really helps me to like provide perspective on these things. Because what we do basically is these things are like very difficult to talk about. No one like sits down with their friends and say, let's talk about inclusivity. That's not something very common. So what we do is we give people that platform, and it's amazing to see what people have been through, what they've experienced. People who you're hanging out with every day, just the stories they have, listening to your peers share that really connects with people. So I like to say it's a form of consensual education almost. It's one of those things where if that peer of yours was to go on Facebook and comment on your status or something, that's a very different dynamic. It's a lot more threatening. It's a lot more coded. Whereas what we provide is, hey, what have you been through? Oh, really? How'd that feel? And then your peers are listening to that, and it's very raw. It's very emotional. It's in person, up front, up close. And that elicits some pretty cool responses. I've had people come up to me after facilitations and say, oh, I no longer feel appropriate approaching race from a colorblind perspective, or I no longer am going to say that's so gay. I didn't know it was actually hurting my brother, my sister in this way. And that's not to say that that's exclusively to Greek organizations. It happens all across the board. And actually, some of the favorite facilitations I've done involve when professors jump in and say, I have no idea my students experienced that. And it's so important to be a professor and to teach and engage with students as opposed to teach at students.
And so you are all constantly having conversations with each other and with the groups you're working with. This last semester has been really dynamic on campus. We've seen racism brought to the forefront of our campus conversation. Have the conversations that you've been having with people changed over the past semester?
Yes and no. So it's one of those things where we've actually been getting this question a lot. We've been getting questions of the form, like, what are you doing now? And things like that. And the interesting thing is, you can't necessarily say that racism popped out of nowhere, that this stuff just, you know, this has been building for years. And actually, in certain form, this type of dynamicism, as you pointed out, has been happening in, like, repeated bursts at Mizzou. We just happen to have the luxury that it happened in our 4 years here as students. It's been happening frequently, and in 10-year or so bursts, 20-year bursts, whatever you want to call it. And so we've heard this time and time after. This is stuff we knew about. We were not surprised when things took place. For example, when the N-word was shouted at people during homecoming. These are things that, in certain fashion, we actually hear in facilitations. We hear people's stories and things like that. We hear people express views that would actually be the foundation to yell something like that. And so, I mean, have we changed anything? No, we've just been doing what we've always been doing because we've always been hearing this stuff. It's just that for the first time, the community at large has been hearing it too. That's not to say that we don't have more relevant examples now, but in certain form, we've always had relevant examples to give when doing these facilitations. It's just that now people, I guess, believe us more, which is actually pretty useful.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because in some conversations I've had and conversations that I've seen on social media, you know that racism exists, but people weren't aware that people were experiencing it in this like consistent and incredibly outright way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of those things about the way we define like the term privilege, actually, whenever we're doing facilitations, involves the idea of invisibility. So privilege is something that is characteristically invisible to those who hold it until they reach a point where they're able to unlearn some stuff. So best example I always give during facilitations is that of citizenship. How often do you navigate the world thinking, oh my gosh, how lucky I am to be a citizen of this country, when actually there's a lot of stuff afforded to citizens that aren't afforded to people with a green card or stuff like that. For example, my roommate is legally here but is not a citizen. It's incredibly difficult for her to have the bills in her name, for her to have utilities and things like that in her name. And that's something I never have to think about. And so I don't have to think about it. It's a privilege. But it's something that I, even though I know it, like even though I'm talking about it right now, I still don't navigate the world thinking about my citizenship privilege. That's how it is with white privilege, is you don't navigate the world having to think about the color of your skin until it becomes salient enough. Until you become uncomfortable enough to kind of face it, which is why, which is where protests are actually very effective. They make people uncomfortable, and it's one of those things where in facilitations, we always kind of say, hey, uncomfortable is good. It's where you grow. nothing easy or nothing good ever comes from some super easy process. And so that uncomfortability is something that we definitely generate in our facilitations. We just make sure that people feel safe with that uncomfortability.
That was Revu Desgupta, the student coordinator for diversity peer educators at Mizzou. As we were working on this show, Helen Tian of Intersection created an online survey to collect points of view from members of our community. One of the questions was, how do you experience diversity or lack of diversity at Mizzou? We selected some of those answers, and members of our Intersection team read them here.
Mizzou seems pretty diverse to me.
Every form I filled out asked what my race was. Why does that matter? It's uncomfortable and makes me feel like I will be treated different by my answer.
Irrelevant and empty question. I go to Mizzou for its academic merit, not racial diversity or lack thereof.
There is plenty of diversity and no sense of racism on campus.
I oftentimes do not encounter any diversity at Mizzou. As a graduate student, I find that most of the individuals I interact with are either white or international students, and that there is a distinct lack of U.S. non-whites, specifically Hispanic and Black.
When a racially sensitive incident happened to me earlier this year, I wanted to talk about it with someone who understood, someone from my ethnic background. I particularly wanted to talk to a faculty member from that background, but there are no Latino, Latina faculty members in my department, or even any ethnic minorities. I had to reach out via email to a faculty member in a different department, who I'd never met before, on the suggestion of a friend who was once her student. I wanted to talk to her about the struggles of being a minority, particularly a Mexican-American on this campus, because I had no one else to talk to about it. This is a predominantly white institution, and faculty and staff members of my department and graduate school cohort are all white. She never responded, and I don't blame her. I'm not her student, and she doesn't owe me anything. But at the time, I was so desperate for someone to understand where I was coming from and to feel validated and encouraged by someone from my background that I was willing to give it a shot. I ended up never getting to talk to anyone about that issue, and I dealt with it largely alone. I ended up resorting to checking books out from the library about the minority Latina experience in graduate school because it was the closest thing to a resource I had. There are few Latino grad students to turn to for support. Non-minority students don't need to look far for advice and counsel from someone who looks like them and who's been in their shoes. They take it for granted that their professors, TAs, and classmates will probably look like them and understand their experience. As a minority, you don't get that privilege.
Thanks to everyone who contributed to our online survey by answering the question, how do you experience diversity or lack of diversity at Mizzou? Alana Diggs is co-chair of Student Group Forefront, which is the Council for Minoritized Student Groups and Student Voices at the university.
We basically find ways to support students who are in organizations that basically are just not in the majority. So whether that's sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, gender, religion, those are the things that we just give monetary support to, or we support them in any way that they need to get their name out there or anything that they need, we work with.
For you to lead an organization like this, it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of energy, and students are already incredibly busy. Why is it important for you to have this role and to fulfill it?
That's a really great question, because sometimes I ask myself that with how much I got myself into.
Mm-hmm.
But the main reason is because I realized that I couldn't sit back and just let things happen, that there is a void on this campus, and there are plenty of students that can fill that void, and I felt that I was one of them. And for me, that it is quite a workload, not just emotionally, but also with the amount of outreach that I wind up doing and all the connections that I have to make, and on top of schoolwork and work and all those other things. So it is a commitment. I realized that even when I did want to decrease my workload, I really couldn't emotionally let myself sit back and watch as things happened. That doesn't mean that not being on the front lines is a detriment to society. It really just meant that for me, I knew what my limits were and I knew what my strengths were, and I wanted to contribute the strengths that I did have. And it's important to me because when I'm sitting in class, I realize how much better our school can be, because I do love this school and I want to make it better. And it would be fantastic if we were the school that figured out this race problem. And I want to contribute to that change, and I want my voice to be heard. And I know I don't represent everyone who is a woman or every person who is a person of color or every middle-class person, but I do represent myself, and I feel like that needs to be heard on this campus to get different perspectives. And that's why it's important to me, really.
And when we talk about some of the things that you see that need to change that you can't just let pass you by, what are some of those things that you've thought, you know, I need to step forward and make myself heard?
Yeah, there are some things that I feel like are very imminent, and then some things that I feel like are going to take a lot of change over time. And the imminent ones mostly are, for example, when I'm sitting in class, I don't feel like I should be hearing my teacher saying that it's a woman's fault if she is assaulted. I feel like that contributes to a culture where students are not physically safe, and that's imminent danger to me. That those are changes that need to occur now, and changing our mindset when it comes to physical safety, especially with everything that happened in these past few weeks with Peyton Head and threats and Yik Yak and everything that occurred. There is a threat to this campus, whether it's physical or emotional. This is going to hinder our students from doing their best, and that reflects poorly on our institution. And those are the things I think need to be changed now. And then as for the things that need to be changed over time, cultural change takes time. And there's only so much that can occur once at a time. And I realize this because we are really trying to unravel decades, for some people, however old they are, years and years of socialization. For example, when you explain to someone that what they are doing is inherently infringing on the rights of other people, they feel like they're losing part of their culture if they have to change that. Some of that's language. Referring to someone as retarded, for example, might have been just part of their culture, and they feel like they're losing part of themselves if they feel like they have to reform. And it takes a long time for people to realize really why that is offensive or why that creates an unsafe place for other people. And because of that, cultural change takes time. And it starts now. That these things can occur now is really something that needs to be seen amongst everybody, from the top down, from the administration to the students, to everybody that has a stake in this campus. We can start now. And that means changing our language. That means encouraging faculty to reach out to different students with different perspectives and to really understand how to teach a variety of students. That means looking at our curriculum and making sure that this is a curriculum that is inclusive of all identities. That means understanding why gender-neutral bathrooms might be a good idea, or understanding why co-ed dorms might be a good idea. There's just a lot of small institutional changes that can contribute to cultural change, and they really play off each other. They're not mutually exclusive. So cultural change begins with some of the icky stuff that we have to see inside ourselves and getting rid of those things before we can actually encourage others to change as well.
And while we've been, I think in recent months, and also while we've just been talking about this show and about conversations that are happening or need to happen on campus, people often comment that these aren't comfortable conversations to have for anybody, really, but that there's sort of this need to for everybody to put ourselves out there and have those uncomfortable conversations. Do you find that people in forefront or the people that you come into contact with on campus are thinking about having those conversations today?
It's funny because if you had asked me a while ago, I probably would have said definitely not. But given everything that's happened on campus with the hunger strike and just everything in the past 15 months, people are reaching out. That is a really great thing to have these conversations. There are a lot of facets to it. One is tokenization, which is kind of essentially using someone from one identity to talk about that entire group. And that has become exhausting for many of our students on campus, especially since if we're talking specifically about the Black community, there's less than 8% of Black students on our campus, it becomes very exhausting for them to explain something that they might not even understand as well. So that's why these conversations are very uncomfortable. One, because where do you have them? Two, because maybe this is the first time you've ever talked about it. But it is very important because we have to remember that when we're having these conversations, that this is where it begins. That understanding why we act the way we do, why change needs to occur, is the most important. And the people who need to be having the conversations are the people with the power in our society, which means that these conversations, like we said, some of the people that have never had these before, the people that don't feel like they have to think about this all of the time, are the people that need to be going to their friends and explaining to them why it's wrong to scream the N-word to someone when they're driving down Greektown, or why it's wrong to post threats on Yik Yak, or why it's wrong to victim blame when a woman or anybody who is a sexual assault victim is assaulted. And it starts there with the people that have the power, the people that don't have to think about these things. If they take the initiative to think about it, that's where change occurs. And we all benefit from it.
And I think there's sort of a generational gap in terms of the language that's used a lot of times surrounding campus and what's been happening in recent months. Especially I find the word safe space is something that college students are used to hearing and have a concept of. But people who are even a little bit older did not grow up with that word, and it's sort of, or that phrase, and it's interpreted in a lot of different ways. Some people see it as, you know, a space where nobody's ever challenged on anything, and everybody is just like incredibly, incredibly politically correct all the time, so much so that you could never hear anything that you could possibly find offensive. And other people would interpret it in ways where everybody there just feels physically safe in an environment. Yeah. How do you talk about safe space as a student at Leader?
I love that question because when I went home for Thanksgiving, I was talking to some of my neighbors, some of my family friends, and I asked them what the civil rights movement looked like for them 50 years ago. And I explained to them what was going on in Mizzou, and they were laughing because they said, this is the exact same conversation we had 50 years ago, which was both discouraging and encouraging at the same time, that we have made progress, but there's still a lot more to go. And the concept of safe space is really interesting because, at least when my parents were growing up and their friends were growing up, there wasn't such thing as a safe space. It just didn't exist. And that's starting to be something that we can create here on our campus with the changes that we have made generationally. And it's interesting, like you said, because some people don't understand that safe space doesn't necessarily mean physical safety. It means the safety to have these difficult conversations without judgment or without threats. So whether you're the privileged person or whether you're the oppressed person, it's a place for you to learn, and it's a place for you to grow and create change. And that is something that I don't think the other generation may have had. And that's why it seems like there's a big disconnect. Even when we're talking to administration, I realized a couple months ago, about 15 months ago, when we had these conversations about what a safe space was with administration, they didn't realize that we were not talking about our physical safety. We were talking about being in a state of mind where we feel like we are a part of this campus, where I can go to class and not feel ostracized or tokenized, or when I can just walk around campus and not feel like I am othered or that I'm different than everyone else. And that's what a safe space is. And that's very important so that every identity can feel like they can learn. And I think that the next generation, or the generations even to come, hopefully there will be a lot more safe spaces for them as well, just like there are more for me than there were for my parents.
That was Alana Diggs, co-chair of Student Group Forefront, which is the Council for Minoritized Student Groups and Student Voices at the university. Now, Kara Tabor of our community outreach team brings us two students' thoughts on diversity and inclusivity.
So my name's Miranda Reese. I am a computer science and IT major. I'm a junior.
So when you hear the words inclusivity and diversity, which are both being used in increasing frequency on campus these days because of the things that have happened on campus this semester, what do these words make you think of?
Definitely acceptance, especially just on an individual holistic basis. I think that diversity is kind of just seeing somebody for just who they are and not discriminating or holding any prejudices against them. And definitely inclusivity is a part of that and just interacting with them.
Now that there has been change at the top in the form of administrative changes, what else do you think needs to continue to happen on campus to ensure that there is a more inclusive environment?
I think that it's important for students to not be afraid to have these sorts of discussions that are occurring on campus, you know, and voicing out their opinions. I'm accepting of, you know, both points of views as long as it's an amicable kind of peaceful talk or discussion that I think that in the end, if you emerge better from it, then, you know, you've educated yourself, maybe educated others, and that in itself is just one way to come to a solution. Obviously, you can't expect overnight racism to magically vanish, but I think that there are changes that we can gradually begin to make the campus a better place.
My name is Adrienne Sifkis, and I'm studying history and political science, and I'm a sophomore. Just thinking about the recent events on campus and how they've kind of changed the meaning of diversity and inclusivity, I think they're making especially inclusivity more important because it's not just necessarily enough to bring people from different backgrounds to your schools. You have to have those discussions about understanding, I guess, different cultures and different socioeconomic positions. And I think a lot of it is just by talking with people and having these discussions, then we can all be more informed about it and therefore be more inclusive with other people.
Now that there have been administrative changes in the wake of the events that have taken place on campus this semester, what else do you think needs to happen?
We've changed administration, so we've worked at the problems that were on the quote-unquote top, and now what really needs to happen is change from within our student body. Just going back to what I was saying about people discussing and people talking about these issues, I think that can't stop. That needs to continue, and we need to improve ourselves individually as students now that we've worked on the administration, now that we can hopefully see things from them that we look for and that we want for our university. Well, we need to be more accepting of each other, and we need to be willing to learn about everyone's different backgrounds and then point it out when someone says a microaggression or something that might make someone uncomfortable. Just doing small things like that to make everyone feel more welcome here.
Thank you for spending your time with us here at Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I want to thank our producers, Katie Eisterhold and Eileen Lee, and our community outreach team of Helen Tien and Kara Tabor. And of course, thank you to our guests, Rivu Desgupta and Alana Diggs, and to the people who responded to our questionnaire and spoke with our team. Intersection will return in the new year with a new season of shows on Monday evenings at 6:30. In the meantime, keep the conversation going. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection, right here on KBIA 91.3 FM.